This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
It's Shake Them Ropes. My name is Chris Novembruno. I am not only the founding member of the Big Guy Muscle and Fitness, and what was the other thing that Jericho said? Horror Club or whatever. I'm not only a president and owner of the Big Guy Muscle and Fitness and generally being awesome club. I am also a member of it. And with me, as always, as a visitor today, is Jeff Hawkins. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
I'm a year older. I had a birthday on Wednesday.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You did. That's right. I sent you a card.
Yeah.
I sent the gag gift.
I am not only the president of the Hair Club for Men, I'm also a client. Yes. It's been an interesting morning for me. One of my followers works at a radio station where I grew up around. It's just one of those things where, like, man, I remember sending out demos to those types of stations and always wanted to be in radio. And luckily, podcasting came along because I don't have that deep bass voice for radio. I have a sidekick voice, so I try and be a sidekick.
I got to tell you, the on-air, like the one-hour tightly measured by spoonfuls format, it's a really tough format, and it's not for everybody. It's really hard to work within the margins of 6 minutes and 15 seconds.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to spin records. I liked music. I wanted to work at like a classic rock station. I could have been there forever, you know. Here's Foghat with Slow Ride on WAFX 106.9 The Fox. You know, anything like that I'd be happy with. But, you know, it's
crazy. I had that same dream. I'm a little younger than you, but, like, I had that same dream when I was doing, like, radio classes and such when I was younger. And I don't know why it never occurred to me when I was younger that, like, one day computers would completely make the idea of the rock radio DJ more or less obsolete. Like, radio stations in the 90s, you know, we hear DJs on the air all the time and be like, oh, yeah, I'd like to be a DJ. That certainly launched a lot of people's dreams of getting on the air and, you know, announcing your favorite record or favorite band's new album or their new hit single and that sort of thing. But it should have been fairly obvious to us, like, around 1998 that there was going to eventually be heavy automation of all playlists and playlist curation.
Well, we had playlists when I worked at a commercial station in college because we had a student-run commercial station. And we had playlists. You have your heavy rotation. You have your, you know, there's a style to putting a format together and things like that. I'm just it was one of those things, though. I also thought when I was in my 20s that radio personalities make a lot of money on the local level, and that's just not true in small markets. You know, that's why they're out there doing, you know, Saturday, you know, you have the pop-up tent with the station logo and giving out, you know, coupons for pizza at a Pep Boys or something. You know, there was a lot of glamour, I thought, to it, and it turns out not to be the case.
Yeah, this is the mistake that so many of us make when we're younger, where you equate it, and this is a fallacy, you equate fame and profile with money, yes. And they're not the same thing.
Yes, like it's odd because in LA, I have friends who are very well known, who in certain circles who don't make a lot of money, and then I have friends who are kind of known. You know, like commercial actors, it would surprise you how much money they make per ad. And I have a friend who gets booked. I mean, he's the dad on every other commercial, and you're just like, God, you're raking in money, and I hate you. I wish I had your look. So, Money in the Bank is coming up, Chris. I have a theory about Money in the Bank, and it leads to our discussion of, you know, Q1 and other things. I think WWE has had a very slick way to save a lot of money.
By running this pay-per-view at Titan Towers where they already have the costs anyway, so they don't have to pay for any of the upkeep or anything, and you just tape it right there in this building that you already own that you're already having to pay to keep the lights on.
Hear me out. It gets even better, because if you recall, one of the things they did when COVID came down is they delayed moving into their new building in Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, right. Sure.
So what they've now done is they've fired a bunch of staff in that building. Now they have all that equipment and stuff that they don't want to store and they don't necessarily want to bring over to the new building. You have a new nice office space and you don't, and you know, when you do these types of things and you're a big company like that, you always, you know, get equipment to fit inside there as opposed to bringing a lot of, you know, your old cubicles and stuff like that. So they could just destroy everything in the building as opposed to paying somebody to take it down or put it in storage and write it off as a business expense and then just sublet the building after they've cleaned it all out.
Yeah, it's kind of genius. You could write off all the damages as a business expense or, put on the show. No, I mean, look, it is kind of genius. You cannot like the way that Vince has been running the company and not approve of any of the moves that he's made over the last quarter, but still also recognize that the guy has, you know, a nest to protect and put yourself in the shoes of somebody you actually like. This would be a very cagey move if this was somebody you actually liked and you'd be applauding it. So, yeah, good on Vince. This is not necessarily going to be a visually great show, I don't anticipate, but I will give him creativity points on the business side.
Some interesting twist to this Money in the Bank pay-per-view. we're filling out the rosters for both matches. Carmella being added to the women's side after beating Mandy Rose. Otis being added to the men's side. And also taken out of the match, Apollo Crews. Raw had a story of him, you know, being, you know, this being a big opportunity and then him having a great match, you know, with Andrade and then hurting his knee and now him being devastated. And now we have to have a new replacement. And, oh, it just so happens on Monday we had the return of Jinder Mahal. So I fully expect Jinder Mahal to get that sixth spot.
Now, do you think that they got Jinder Mahal back and they were just like, well, this guy has been sitting on the shelf for far too long. This is money that has just been sitting there not being made. Let's get Jinder out there. They've been hindering him for too long. Don't hinder the Jinder.
My first thought was, are they planning to run a show in India? And I know that's cynical as hell, but I was wondering what India's social distancing policies are right now.
I mean, it's okay. I get that it's cynical, or I definitely understand how someone could hear that at first blush and remember that, or think that that's cynicism. But do recall that the entire Mahal push, what was it, in 2017 or 2016, was really premised and predicated by the fact that WWE at the time was expanding into India, and they believed, however errantly, that Jinder Mahal would help them improve their standing in India.
Yeah, there's two divergent things. I'll get to the Jinder point in a second, but it leads to, there are stories on all these shows. You have Apollo Crews here. You kind of have Drake Maverick on NXT, and you have Otis on SmackDown. They're telling the perpetual underdog stories, and God love them. They've made Otis into an even bigger oaf than he is, because now all he does is, oh, yeah, all the time. He's the Kool-Aid man now. He is now the wrestling Kool-Aid man.
We were worried about this. We were worried that they were never actually going to think too hard about what an Otis match is supposed to look like and what emotive sort of notes an Otis match should hit, which is like one part comedy, but another part, ooh, and ah, wow, he's impressive and strong. We've just completely eschewed the impressive and strong part of Otis's gimmick to just, look at him, he's kind of fat. Fatty, fat.
Yeah, I'm a little more worried about just and we talk about this a lot, the prism through which the guy on top looks at underdog stories, because this Drake Maverick story is working. I hate to tell people this, but it's working. You see it in the reactions to the shows. You kind of hear it, you know, in just talking in the general chatter. You had the Apollo Crews story. They're writing these underdog stories for underdogs to get crushed in the end. And they've been doing this for a long time. They've kind of done it with Gargano. They kind of did it with Daniel Bryan quite a bit. It's like, if you're good and you have a dream and you work hard and you overcome the odds, look, you're not supposed to win. It's one of those things where I don't need Rudy all the time. Don't get me wrong. I don't need the sappy, you know, some 5'8" kid makes the Notre Dame football team and gets a tackle on a play, because yeah, that's somewhat unrealistic. But we also have noted that if Vince were booking David versus Goliath, he'd want Goliath to win.
He would be impressed by Goliath. He'd be like, Goliath has incredible size. I wonder
the charisma. I mean, he's out there talking
a little bit of college football, maybe.
Did you ever play college football? Yes, Philistine University. I was a linebacker there because of my size, sir.
I was the center on the basketball team prior to that.
Yeah, No, I was a point guard. I'm actually small for my size, to be honest with you. But, yeah, it's just one of those weird things where it's like they spent 3 weeks building up Apollo Crews, and you think there's going to be something there, and there might still be. But you also hold out the possibility that Jinder was ready to come back, and Vince just decided, well, you know what, scrap that. I'm gonna push him, although Jinder's not officially yet in the match. So I'm putting the cart before the horse a little bit. There will be a gauntlet match of sorts to see who will be the third Raw representative in Money in the Bank. But I fully expect it to be Jinder Mahal, who also, in his debut, crushed Akira Tozawa, who is in your cruiserweight tournament, which is supposed to be your draw for Wednesday nights. And then on Wednesday night, they beat Shane Thorne versus Dexter Lumis, who is supposed to be a draw for your tag team that MVP is going to be managing on Raw. And I'm just like, are there only 12 guys and they're doing round robin and they're just deciding we need to beat people tonight? Or are they actually putting thought into this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real problem is that they just have a group of people informally bunched as the enhancement talent right now, and they're just doing matches to do matches for the sake of doing matches. It was a danger that we were talking about a couple of months ago when this all began, which is it's fine to keep taping television, but make sure that when you're taping matches and booking matches that they are purposeful. And that the wins and losses are purpose-driven and have a grander meaning in the narrative storyline. Otherwise, you get to a point 2 months down the road where Tony Nese coming through the curtain doesn't mean anything at all. To stay a little bit on the underdog booking and the underdog story in WWE, I think part of the organization's lack of discipline, and I do think that it comes from the top, comes from McMahon for all of those years in The Rock storylines and Stone Cold Steve Austin storylines, having to be the guy who got the comeuppance at the end. And I think part of it is that in real life, Vince likes to stick his thumb in the eye of the underdog. And so there's always been a little bit of sailing against the wind that has been done by the organization when telling these underdog stories, because normally the underdog's on the other side of the table from Vince McMahon.
Yeah, he's the lone wolf who did it all on his own and had no help. And
he hates that. I mean, you know, go to that promo. What did I text you about? Was it it was the Johnny Gargano promo. Who was doing it on the other side? Dijakovic.
Yeah.
It's Dijakovic saying, oh, you should be so grateful to the organization.
Yeah, they're giving you the opportunity to grab the brass ring. Blah, 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 blah. You know, you can see the...
He's saying that without irony as a babyface.
Yeah. It's just... It's weird. But again, who are your straight ahead baby faces right now? And they're few and far between. The, you know, the white meat, like we say white meat, like derisively, but dude, you, I mean, like,
you
I,
actually need someone who is flavorless. And every recipe, like it, you know, the reason they use kind of white meat is it's about a flavor. Recipes need a thing that can absorb the flavor. You can't just have all spices, otherwise you have an inedible dish.
Yeah, I watched two old wrestling shows last night. I watched an episode of UWF with the Fantastics and Terry Taylor versus the Bushwhackers and Jack Victory in a barbed wire cage match. And every time any of the baby faces had their heads put near that barbed wire, the women start screaming, no, don't cut up their pretty face. It's a trope that works. And then I ended up watching an old 93 ECW show where it's like Public Enemy versus Bad Company. And it's just a bunch of Philadelphia fans who hate everybody. And it was just night and day. And you're just watching that going, yeah, people need somebody to cheer for occasionally.
Yeah, I think it's good for an organization to have these quote-unquote white meat babyface guys who you can send out to the fans, not have to worry about breaking their character because their character is literally just people like me. And you can have them go out and represent working for WCW, UWF, WWF, WWE, whoever, and you don't have to worry about quote-unquote exposing the business. Not like we're worried about that in 2020 like we would have been in 1980. But you know what I mean. You don't want to break people's characters.
Well, no, but there's a point you made in there that I really like because it's something that happened in, I would say, pre-98 promos a lot. You could put over the company while doing it through the lens of putting yourself over. Like I'm so proud to represent
you. Like, if you remember Hacksaw when he was in WCW, he used to be awesome at this, all the way down to coming down to the ring with the WCW flag.
Well, yeah, I mean, even the heels would do it in Jim Crockett. It's like, I'm very honored to be working here for Jim Crockett Promotions, where the finest wrestlers come in. You have your Arn Andersons and Tully Blanchards, and even you, Dusty Rhodes. I don't like you, but you're a hell of a man, and, you know, that kind of thing. And then the white meat babyfaces would go, you know, I'm just so thankful to have this opportunity to represent the NWA, blah, 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 and I'm just going to do my best for these fans here, and I'm going to make them proud. You know, it ain't rocket science, as they say.
I think part of it, too, is in the giving gravitas to the organization, it's really helpful to have a name that sounds prestigious when you say it out entirely. So, the National Wrestling Alliance, World Championship Wrestling.
Yeah.
And yeah. I always felt like TNA never had that ability. And to a certain extent, neither does World Wrestling Entertainment. You can't say it and have a gravitas, a heft to it. Once you get to that E, it feels weird.
Yeah, it certainly does. Speaking of weird, Chris, a twist in this year's Money in the Bank matches. I don't know if you have heard this or not, so I may just be getting a hot take here, which is always awesome. Both Money in the Bank matches, the men's and the women's, will be happening simultaneously.
What?
All right.
What kind of clustery quandary are they planning on shooting and airing on live television? Because they want to run this show live, right?
I think the end is going to be live. I think the rest is going to be
right? Yeah. You'd have to, because I mean, the amount of crews that you would need to be running live and the amount of coordination you'd need to be doing in a truck live, it's bedlam. And what is the narrative point of this? There has been nothing to merit this stipulation of the men and the women both going at the same time, other than the subtext that all of them ultimately work at the pleasure of Vince McMahon and World Wrestling Entertainment. And so, like, what this whole fight through Titan Towers thing's really about is a metaphor for fighting and clawing and scratching your way to the top of the company.
Well, Chris, it's it's both men and women equally climbing the corporate ladder at the same time.
I can't.
I'm gonna lose it if I try and make that a serious point. I'm sorry. I tried, Chris. I wanted to really, you know, bring that underlying message in there. That look, they're
you
all.
You can't have gender equality if you're treating all of the workers like shit.
No, but there will be two briefcases hanging, one for men, one for women, and I believe everybody just starts at the same time and it goes wherever it goes. Like I said a few weeks ago, you're going to have two people busting into Vince McMahon's office while he's working just for that comedy spot.
Otis and Mandy.
Well, Mandy's not in it.
Oh, she's not. Oh, that's right. She's not in it.
She lost in it.
But then maybe Mandy's helping Otis and maybe, yeah. But I think that there's obviously going to be an Otis and Mandy spot in here.
Yeah, there's going to be that. I think one of the heel women is going to do something to one of the babyface men. Now that Apollo Crews is out, it's probably going to be either Nia Jax or Shayna Baszler, like, killing Daniel Bryan or something. they could do something crazy like Nia Jax wins the men's briefcase and keeps it, you know, just to get talking points out there. I wouldn't put past them. I don't think they will, but I wouldn't, you know. My thought was going to be that Sasha Banks was going to be in this match and eventually cash it on Bayley, so that's not happening either. But yeah, it's going to be a bit of a mess. It's going to take a long time because you have two matches going on at the same time and their focuses are going to be all over the place.
Yeah, this is going to be at least an hour of the show, right?
You're not going to have a great narrative through line if you're cutting in between men's and women's storylines, I think.
Well, and that's, you have to focus issue on six different characters in each part of the plot.
Yes.
I mean, if you're thinking about this as an hour-long television show where now you have 12 characters, two main characters that you have to tell consistent through lines through, and then supporting cast, not all of which, on there's six on each side, but the supporting cast, at least two or three in each match, needs to be serviced in some way by the narrative storytelling. Just divvied up evenly, that is no more than 10 minutes per person if you have six people, but you're gonna have two people prioritized. So like, I mean, like, the pie gets really, really small, and it seems like for the people involved in this match, if you're not winning the briefcase, you're probably not going to get much of a rub out of this.
Yeah, I don't know yet. I'm gonna hold off on a lot of this until after it happens, naturally. But we'll give our picks next week when we know everything that's going on.
The other thing is you're going to have to figure out how to draw eyeballs to watch this spectacle.
Well,
yeah.
Speaking of eyeballs, both shows are under 2 million viewers. I believe Raw's under 2 million. I know SmackDown last night was 1.8, I want to say. People just aren't watching wrestling, and I don't think it has anything to do with crowds. I got to be honest with you. I think that's a part of it, but I think it's just with families being quarantined together. These days, wrestling is not, it's not the sit down as a family and watch kind of show that you think it is.
Our relationship with TV is totally different than it was 30
that
years
too.
Ago.
I mean, you have all these streaming services. I get that. But if you have like one TV and you all just kind of want to hang out together and watch something, usually live sports would be a good one that everybody could agree on. But nobody except me. I mean, if you're over the age of 8 and a male, it's hard to talk anybody else in your house into watching the WWE. It just is.
Especially WWE.
Yes.
Yeah, 2020, even 2010 to 2020 WWE. It is a really, really hard sell right now.
You know, most people will sit down and watch a Disney movie or a Netflix movie or things like that. But yeah, our relationship with television has changed. And our relationship with the people that we're, you know, that we're quarantined with. If you are quarantined with people, you have to take into account their tastes. And maybe they don't want to watch it. So that's what I'm looking at. But I do think
have more screens. To your point now, I mean, just the cost of a television, which I'm aware that Timothy Thatcher is still working on. He's hoping to get a really good deal on a TV. The good news for Timmy is that there are good deals to be had on televisions all over the place now. But I mean, if you remember back when, like I remember in the 90s, being in my parents' house, they had the nice new hardwood floors installed, and my dad got a big screen television through his job. He got like a really good discount on it. It was still, this is in the 90s. I still remember that was well over $1,000 in like the 1990s money. That was the big screen in the living room, and we had a junky 1980s TV downstairs that had like little push buttons to actually trigger the different channels. It only went up to 15. You could connect the cable to the back, but like TVs were heavy, cumbersome, cost more money even for the cheap ones. Whereas now you can get a good TV for $200. I mean, you could get a bad TV for under $100 if you go to the right places. And if you're thinking about doing it on used, you can get it. You can get a decent TV for well under $100. Like they're just far more ubiquitous. And the reason I bring that up is that means that the average house has more TVs too. So screen wars is less of a thing too now. So the hope that you would maybe get lapsed bands, you have the kid who's 8 years old who's still watching WWE for John Cena or whatever you want your narrative to be, right? The hope is that you're going to get that 35 to 50 year old who remembers wrestling and watched when Stone Cold and Rock were doing their thing in Goldberg. Maybe they'll check back in to check out and see what Gronkowski and Goldberg and some of these quote unquote legends are doing during WrestleMania. That didn't happen. And it's not going to happen. And I don't think getting back out into the fans, getting back into the crowds is going to change the downward trajectory. I think that COVID-19 and the pandemic has exacerbated that downward trajectory. But this is a trajectory that wrestling was on well before COVID-19, mm-hmm. well before 2020. It's something that Jeff and I have been talking about on this show for years. The ratings keep going lower, and every year it seems like we're confronted with the headline of new record low for Raw. How many times have we ran that headline on this show? They've all been true. It's not like we're making them up. But what's been happening is that Raw continues to arc further and further downward. I mean, it's a big problem for this company because I think America's relationship with the product that we have known as professional wrestling has fundamentally changed. And the products that are currently producing professional wrestling have not fully adapted to reflect that reality.
Yeah, I'm.
How's that for a hot take?
I'm trying to remember it all. I just think we're in a downward part of the cycle, even though it's so weird because we had bidding wars over this product because of the thought that it could change and adapt with the times, and they're just not doing that.
It is so crazy that investors went like ham.
He is dead. He is absolutely dead.
They went ham on WWE when America's relationship with wrestling and with just heat for wrestling is way dead. I love the Vice series. The Vice series has been very much scratching an itch of mine for wrestling. But going back and like watching this week, John Stossel and him talking about the 80s relationship with Dr. D. It took me back a little bit to when I was a kid, even in the 90s, when the business is being discussed. You have steroids, the death of Owen Hart. Vince McMahon is talking about the Montreal Screwjob on TV. We just had a very different relationship with this product. It was much more part of our life and our national, like, and around the margins of society and culture at all times than it is right now.
Chris Novembrino says, bring cocaine back into wrestling. Okay, gotcha.
certainly it would make the promos more entertaining, Jeff.
Oh, gee. Yeah, there were a lot of promos that were done on illegal substances, as they say.
Yeah, it's like the entirety of the Ultimate Warrior's career.
One piece of news that dropped. We did have another release in the WWE. Curtis Axel won Joseph Curtis Hennig, son of Mr. Perfect, former Intercontinental Champion, Curtis Axel.
Triple H, thank you very much.
Yes, the DQ or count-out win that really elevated his career. He's 40. I have doubts he's going to get another wrestling job. I do. I think
– I don't know how much he's ever loved the business. I think that this is – it's in his family. It's in his blood. But I think some people are just gravitated towards wrestling and worked their whole life and rushed to get into wrestling, whereas I think Joe was born into wrestling. His grandpa was a wrestler. His dad was a wrestler. It's in his family. And
both his brothers were wrestlers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. So, I think – and in families like that, it's not that like the Harts. It's not like they don't all love wrestling, but – some people love wrestling more than others. And my suspicion is that Joe is probably the member of the family who loves wrestling a little bit less, but loves his family and loves the family business and respects it very, very much.
I won't go that far. I think he loves wrestling. I just think he has the unfortunate specter of being the son of a wrestler who died young. And he has a famous name and he has expectations. I think he loves wrestling. I mean, just listening to interviews he's done, I do think he loved it. He had a job for a long time in the WWE. He was with Florida Championship Wrestling back in the day. He's also, to me, very, very underappreciated, and I'll tell you why. He is the guy that whenever an old guy had to get back in ring shape, they'd send Axel to work with him. And
Okay. All right. You
know, he helped The Rock get back in shape. I believe he helped Goldberg get back in ring shape at one time too. He was that guy. And
so let me modify this. Maybe he doesn't love being a performer. Maybe what he loves about the business
is a chance though.
Yeah, no, I think that that's true too, but I also I think some people like the bright lights and like really working in a character more than others. And, you know, Perfect was a great character. Mr. Perfect was really awesome at working in a character. The Curtis Axel character has always been a little bit for want of, and maybe what Joe sinks his teeth into is what you're describing, which is the working out, staying fit. You get to work and wrestle and train up these people who you like and respect. And like, he loves that culture, loves that part of the business. And then there's the other part where you have to come through the curtain and he does that too, because that's part of the job.
Well, there's a few hiccups in here, I'm thinking. Number one, there's not a lot of – unless you have other skills when you're 40. See, I look at him as possibly making a small business of some kind for his own. In another day and time, the Fortunate Sons gimmick from SCW, which was him and his brother and – I think it was both his brothers and another legacy type of guy. That's the kind of crap that gets over in old-timey territory wrestling. It's just Vince really has no interest in legacy type people. Even
oh no, Vince Tate's putting over a business, or I'm sorry, a family as a brand, because it's essentially putting over in a way another.
Except for Charlotte Flair, except for Charlotte Flair.
For sure, except for Charlotte Flair. But like it, because you're putting over a brand. I think you know the Charlotte thing to that point is he's not worried about Rick strolling off anywhere at this point.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, but if he was, he wouldn't be putting over Charlotte Flair, I don't think, too. I mean, if he thought that there's a real risk that Rick would defect to AEW and really help, you know, then I think that might change the dynamic of how much we're talking about Charlotte. But, yeah, I just don't think – and also, I guess, Randy Orton. But kind of the same sort of relationship. He's not worried about Bob Orton or Randy Orton kind of running off and doing something with it. But, you know, he doesn't want to put over the roads. He doesn't really – even Legacy. Legacy was never going to be top of the card. It was always going to be upper mid-card kind of territory and never be on top for any length of time because Vince doesn't like that idea.
I erred a bit. It wasn't Hennig and his brothers, I don't think. It was Hennig along with a couple of the DiBiase brothers. I know some people were probably yelling, Jeff's a moron right now, and that's very true sometimes. But, there was some weird combination of him and – one, two, or three of the DiBiase brothers that formed the Fortunate Sons gimmick.
Jeff, don't beat yourself up. I have heard from people that you can be incorrect but still right.
Well, thanks. I'm interested to see what he does. I think he'd be a good trainer somewhere if he wanted to do that. But overall, I could see him as the kind of guy who goes, look, I've made a lot of money in this business. I wasn't a star, but I've made a lot of money. Because just by his tenure, he probably got escalated in terms, even if he wasn't on TV, probably got some.
And if he was like Bobby Eaton smart, you know, like Bobby, the stories were always that he was really good about saving his money, always had like a kit, and made sure that he was never just buying stuff recklessly on the road or whatever. If he was smart and squirreling away his money, he's probably fine.
I'm just interested to see what happens to a guy that age making a big career change at that time. So the only other thing in terms of in-ring, I mean, both shows, I think all these shows are having good wrestling. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we're having interesting choices like Liv Morgan beating Ruby Riott again, because it looks like they see something in Liv finally. But I'm fascinated by the Sheamus build, because Sheamus is a known quantity. We know what Sheamus is and what he's been about, and he's been around for, 13 years? Maybe more? My timeline's off. But they're giving him the squash match treatment, and I know a lot of people are saying now, you know, Jeff, you like squash matches. I do. I think there should be nothing but squash matches until pay-per-views, to be honest with you. Maybe a TV main event here and there. But WWE,
no, but like a lot more wrestling shows should be done through promos on the week-to-week. Yeah.
Yes, but WWE plays by a different set of rules, and they like having, you know, guy versus guy matches, even though they don't have, you know, and they view those as enhancement. But these are real enhancement matches, and those are usually saved for new monsters that Vince sees something in that he wants to build up. I get that they're kind of rebranding Sheamus as angry, intimidating badass, but we know what Sheamus is already.
It's in a rebrand. This is really similar to a character he's been working in various variations for the last 2.5-3 years.
Yeah. It's just one of those things I'm watching this. I'm going, you know what? You could have brought in a Dan Math, for example, Dorian Matha or whatever.
It was Dorian Mack. Yeah. Dan Matha. Yeah.
Mack. And this would work for him. It would work for, you know, if you want to bring in Baba Tunde all of a sudden on the main roster and do that.
It works for the two big Indian guys that they're pushing on NXT right now too.
Yeah.
What's going on with Sheamus, to kind of answer your question, is I think that some of the writers, maybe even Vince himself, have been watching the other channel a little bit on Wednesday nights and have seen the Lance Archer build and really like the Lance Archer build, like the package with Jake, like all of these squash matchy sorts of things that are going on with Lance Archer, and go, well, we can do that with Sheamus. He's kind of a similar casting fit for this kind of character. Let's just do it with Sheamus without any real consideration of why it works when you do it with Lance Archer.
Yeah, I'm it's weird because I just think they're just building him up to beat Daniel Bryan again. I gotta be honest with you. That's what I see. It's like every time they build up a guy like this, It's to feed Daniel Bryan to him, pretty much, and make him a contender. That's the other kind of interesting note for me from the two main shows. Not a whole lot going on in there other than, you know, the story of Apollo Crews on Raw. But Daniel Bryan is currently in his, oh, you guys think this guy sucks? I'm going to get a 3.5-star TV match out of him. And he had a pretty good, fun, entertaining match with one Baron Corbin. And I'm not a Baron Corbin detractor in terms of wrestling. I'm a detractor in terms of the character. I find a little bit grating.
Yeah, in terms of wrestling, he is a light version of the Big Boss Man. He even does some of the same
spots. That's a good one. I'll take that.
No, the slide under the ropes and come back into the ring spot, like that is straight Boss Man. And he does the sidewalk style slam, which he calls a deep six. Like, there's a lot of very Big Boss Man-y type mannerisms to Baron Corbin, but he's not nearly as intimidating as Boss Man, and I don't think he's as talented. But he's still not unskilled, and to be called a big man in the vein of Big Boss Man is a good thing.
Agreed. Yeah, so I really had not a lot on the main roster. I don't believe Asuka was on this week. So Aunt Pam and her friend have made up, which I like. Only they'll probably end up miscommunicating in this tag match. They're having a tag match with Bayley and Sasha versus Lacey Evans and Tamina next week.
Tamina, noted babyface.
Noted babyface to me. Although her social media attempts at babyfacing, I gotta say, she's top notch. She has a sly sense of humor, and I like her. I've always liked her personally because she always has reactions that make me laugh. Like there was a time in Team Bad when it was her, Naomi, and Sasha coming out, and it was when Sasha was doing imitations of her opponents at all times, and she was facing Nikki Bella in a match, and she comes out and she does the Nikki Bella twirl type thing, and Tamina just points and looks and goes, "Can you believe this crap?" I howled at that. But she's trying on social media. You should take a look at her account.
For sure. No,
it's quite entertaining. As for the two Wednesday shows, I think once again it was a winning week for the most part for promos. I'm liking that they finally have gotten to, we're just going to talk to the camera. Although there are some, like the Dijakovic promo. It was a good promo, but I would rather he talk to the camera versus I'm just on a stroll with a cameraman right now.
Yeah, no, he did a nice job with the content he had to deliver. But yes. I do think that the content itself had problems, which I was referencing earlier in the show.
I think it's helping Damian Priest quite a bit in these types of things.
Absolutely. No, and I think Priest is totally the type of guy who should be – his characterization should be done through promos like this, right?
I think both Darby Allin and Cody had great promos at the beginning of AEW. I love that. It really hyped me for the fight.
Yeah. No, I loved the promos from both Cody and Darby Allin. But we'll talk about the Rhodes Brothers matches when we get to those.
Oh, okay. We're gonna go over matches now.
Yeah, if you want to go over matches,
let's get AEW out of the way, and then we'll do NXT because we are kind of treading on toes, but we go where we go. So the heck with it.
We go where we go, and we step on your toe. Put that on a T-shirt. Put it on a bumper sticker.
Our boy Mookie got a little bit more TV time. Noted heel Chris Harrington.
There. I'm saying that for years, it's just great to finally see that recognized on a national level.
I mean, there's a rumor he once kicked a baby. I'm just saying.
I've been hearing a lot of people have been saying it. It's out there. It's in the discourse.
So, what stood out from you from AEW?
So I liked the work in the Darby Allin Cody Rhodes match. Mm-hmm. However, I thought the move to turn Darby into an opportunist was too cute by half. First, if he's going to go opportunist, he needs to just go straight heel. I think that that's important. And then for him to change tactics and still lose and lose in the way in which he did, I think did Darby Allin's character a serious disservice. The promos were great. Darby talking about the reason why he felt his previous losses to Cody Rhodes were not justifiably clean losses in a slightly heelish manner, set the table perfectly for when Cody injures his knee and Darby, you see the gears start turning in his head and the light bulb switches from a bright light to a little bit darker of a light and he tackles that knee. But then, I mean, it should have opened him up to a new palette of moves, a new style of wrestling. That takes Cody Rhodes off of his balance, and then Rhodes loses the match because he's been legitimately surprised by a new side of Darby Allin. Darby Allin goes to embrace that. Instead, Allin comes off of the top, does the coffin drop, and Cody doesn't even really reverse it, per se. Like, he doesn't counter it with, like, a devastating knee to the back or a knee to the back of Darby Allin's head, which would be the obvious way of countering the coffin drop, right? He just rolls him over into a backslide, and then Allin loses in a Wrigley 3 count. I hated that because if you're going to turn over a new leaf, we need to see some sort of reward for it. Otherwise, what's the point, and why would he stick with it?
I think they're very nervous about turning Darby Allin heel. I got to be honest with you. I think they thought about it.
Then don't try to butter your bread on both sides.
They are, and that's what they're doing, is because I think the crowd loves Darby Allin. And I think they're playing this obsessive gimmick hard because they want to make him a heel, but I don't think the crowd's going to go along with it. I think this crowd, the AEW crowd.
He's going to be Sting. What's going to happen is if he goes into heel mode, he's going to come out through the crowd. He's going to appear out of nowhere. He's going to hit somebody with a skateboard or a baseball bat, and the crowd's going to lose their mind every time. Oh, I completely agree with you. Turning the guy heel seems like a fundamental mistake. But if you're going to do it, you've got to friggin' do it.
So you're thinking he's going to be like dark anti-hero.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think that you're right that they're trying to butter their bread on both sides on this. I think it's just – it's a mistake. If he's going to be a babyface, make him a babyface. If he's going to be the underdog, make him the underdog. But if he's going to be a heel and he's going to really embrace the dark side of his nature, then he needs to really do that. Because we've seen what happens when you try to play it in the middle with Finn Balor.
Yeah, no, that's a good comparison right there. Thought the Bubbly Bunch video was better this week. It's obvious some wrestling pundits had not seen the Stuntman video that this was based on. I did like Lou Ferrigno with a taser.
Jack Victory creeped in there too. I appreciated that. Who? Jack Victory.
Oh, was that Jack Victory?
Yeah, there's. I'm pretty sure Jack Victory's in there.
I don't think that's Jack Victory. I think that might be like Duff McKagan or something.
Is it? Okay, I wasn't sure, but like, yeah.
I was going to say, if they got Jack Victory, I know they had Ted Irvine in there.
They had.
That's who you're thinking it was. The guy in the hockey jersey?
Yes.
No, that's Chris. That's Chris Jericho's dad.
Oh, that's his dad. Okay.
That's Ted Irvine, the noted hockey enforcer. Yeah, okay. Oh man. Okay, no, that makes sense now.
He looks like old Jack Victory, am I right?
A little.
Yeah.
Older Jack Victory.
Right, no, like if Jack, no, because I haven't seen Jack Victory in 20 years. I don't know what Jack Victory's up to. Jack Victory and I don't hang out. Jack Victory and I are not boys. I didn't Google Jack Victory.
But we should be. We should all be boys with Jack Victory.
I don't pay my internet bills on time. It doesn't matter. This is America.
If someone knows Jack Victory and someone knows John Tatum, and we can get them both on here to talk about their matches.
Give us a little bit of John Tatum. Dude, an hour of John. Oh, man. Please, come on, people. Let shake them ropes, people. This is me reaching out to you through your headphones. Touch me. Feel me. I'm like Dusty Rhodes coming through your headphones. Get us Hollywood John Tatum. Bring him onto this show.
SRS is now is asking, who do you want me to see a video interview this time? I'm going to put John Tatum and Jack Victory just to troll him.
The Brooklyn Brawler?
I was not the Brooklyn Brawler. The Britt Baker. I was going to say Brooke Baldwin. from CNN, the Brooke Baldwin heel experiment, and she is a heel. No, the Britt Baker experiment is working for me.
Oh yeah, no, I'm calling Rebel Reba.
Yes.
Love it. Like having everyone around Britt Baker hate her and think that she's an inseparable piece of crap, but still have to kind of like kiss her ass a little bit, and Baker doing this self-absorbed I'm a role model stuff. Man, no, this is great. You've said before, I'm stealing your thunder here. This is what the Bailey I'm a role model character should have been templated off of or in the vein of, and Britt Baker has really out role modeled Bailey.
Now here's the thing. I see a lot of people giving Kenny Omega credit because it was his idea to turn her heel. I'm not going to go that far just yet because she was supposed to be basically the baby face of this division after Kylie Rae left, and they just did a terrible job with it. So
yeah, if you're going to give credit for this iteration, you have to give recognition,
yes,
for the redirection, which is a concession that at best, like, this is a redo on the homework assignment to get 50% credit. Like, if you remember back in school, that old gimmick, Like, he gets points for how Britt Baker is going. And if Britt Baker was the original homework, he would have gotten an A on the assignment. But in this case, because it's the second attempt on the assignment, you only get, like, at best a C. And I think he's probably right up on that. But they mishandled Britt Baker. And I also think that they're crutching a little too much on Tony Schiavone and goodwill towards Tony Schiavone to get Baker over and over-relying on it. It's not that it doesn't work, but, I mean, we spent a long time on Tony's appearance this time.
Yeah, I'm here's the thing. It's one of those things where you have to criticize, but you also have to give credit at the same time, because AEW, more than any other company right now, when something's not working, they just drop it and they go another direction. The Nightmare Collective with Brandy and Kia, Awesome Kong.
Yeah, the Dark Order. That was the dog's balls. And we were all talking about it like it was the dog's balls. And the next week, not only did they drop it, they took that opportunity to, like, work it and leave it into storyline by saying, hey, you know, there was that one guy, his heart wasn't really in it. He wasn't even connecting with his punches, which I thought, whoever came up with that, give that person a $500 weekly bonus. Mm-hmm. That was a genius line. No, they've been very good at recognizing when something's not working and abandoning it and being dynamic. And you've got to give them credit for that.
And then Dustin Rhodes and the Murder Hawk Monster. I just like the Murder Hawk. Come on. Murder Hawk is awesome. Straight 80s movie trope right there. I mean, it was a little bloodier than I thought it was going to be. And, you know, I felt
very weird in this particular moment that we're in, right?
I have a logic question, because it used to be taking off the turnbuckle pad and putting a guy into it was a disqualification. But, you know, having Archer standing over his victim, taunting the man who will fight for his brother's honor. I mean, that's straight 80s cheese right there, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, so I liked a lot of beats of this. I thought the match was a little bit longer than it needed to be in this part of the Archer build. I think that Archer should have had obviously a more competitive match than he's had with, like, the no-name people he's been in the ring with. But I think he really should have, and largely he really overwhelmed Dustin Rhodes. So my issue is not even with the way the match was booked. I thought the ratio was right. It was just a little long. I think he should have cut through Rhodes a little bit faster. Rhodes should have been crawling for his brother. I love the people, the wrestlers yelling, the heels all yelling, give up, give up, give up, and really needling Dustin Rhodes. But, yeah, I thought the match was pretty darn good. I had far fewer problems with this than I did with the earlier Cody Rhodes match.
Yeah, there's a lot of long matches. I mean, they had a 40-minute opener on Raw. I mean, that was
you look at the match lengths. Like, I was just, you know, I was looking over at F4W and just reading a recap before we got on the air here. Just reviewing these match lengths and the people, the personnel in these matches – and how long you're giving them in terms of time. And one of the other big problems is because Vince, as we were talking about earlier, not wanting to build up family names with brands, right? Or as brands. Vince doesn't like to build up even wrestlers as brands, which is why you get, like, changed down to one name, or we change your name entirely. We come up with some new look for you that you've never had before. He doesn't build up any of the talent enough to really justify giving any one talent, other than, like, maybe Roman Reigns or Charlotte Flair or whatever, a 40-minute match. And so it's really weird when you see someone like Andrade in a match that's like 36 minutes.
Yeah, and there's no real heat to it either. It's just moves, headlock to rest, moves. I mean, I can watch a 40-minute match if there's a compelling feud to it. But this is just
fan-style booking narrative weaving throughout. Like Tanahashi and Okada, I'm not saying I expect Andrade to be working up at those levels. But, like, you know how New Japan, especially in the early part to the middle part of last decade, really had – they had a good sense of narrative intensity in the matches, right? I think you could do that. You can build up some of these talent. But they keep working – the standard 7-minute WWE match format only extended over 36 minutes.
Yeah.
The same match, but longer. To put this in music terms, so you like the song that's 2 minutes and 45 seconds, right? What if it was 4 minutes, Jeff?
Oh, here, yeah. Sorry, I'm still.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if it was going to be 4 minutes or 7 minutes, or you were going to hear an extended version, you'd hope to hear another section in that song.
Yeah.
Then the verse and the chorus. You'd hope to hear a secret bridge that is like, whoa, that's really different. I didn't know where that was coming from. Like when you're listening to My Sharona by The Knack and all you've ever heard your entire life is the radio edit, and then you hear the actual album version, it's 5 minutes, and it's got this bitchin' guitar solo in the middle, minute 30. And you're like, whoa, this is totally worth me spending this extra time here. There's nothing in a WWE TV match right now that is like that guitar solo in My Sharona.
There's a weird Sweet Home Alabama radio edit that I just don't understand, where it takes out the bridge with the what do they call them, the Skinnerdettes, or the, I forgot what they called the backup singers when they're doing that da, Alabama with the big loud crash cymbals and stuff, and they just replay that guitar thing, and you're like, well, what happened to that other real cool song, cool, you know, building part? And it's just, it throws me off every time I hear that version. I just want to get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if you heard the extended version of Sweet Home Alabama. It was just the first verse, same as the fourth.
That's
verse.
Pretty much what it is. It's just weird, man. One news piece that I thought I'd bring to your attention before we go. Do you have anything else for AEW? I just wanted to.
I thought that they made Moxley do a lot of carrying for the corporate brand in his promo, and it felt awkward.
I also thought the comedy felt a little awkward. I got to be honest with you, and call your grandmother.
Right, right. No, it felt like a weird AEW commercial. There was also a little bit of like, if you remember.
It's a self-aware promo is what it is.
Yeah, it's self-aware. It's like those old Southwest boarding videos that you used to have to watch. When you get on, they tell you how to put your seatbelt on. And they were cheeky and self-referential.
Yeah.
Like Moxley had a little bit of the airplane boarding video energy going on.
Okay. No, that's perfect. I like that. I'll leave it at that. Jerry Lawler, this is a story that we were going to go over when it happened, and I just forgot about. But as always, the explanation makes it much worse. A couple weeks ago, Jerry Lawler called
he bravely flew in and told us all that he was flying in to go in and call this too.
Tozawa sent on a ramen noodle moonsault. Now, here's his explanation. He said he was doing commentary in 2016 with Mauro Ranallo, and given Ranallo's history with Japanese wrestling, he heard him call a move something that he figured was made up because he had never heard it before. He said he later made up some names for what he thought would be funny moves to go back at Ranallo at when he called a move. I would say something like, there's a ramen noodle moonsault, and he would say, oh, King, you know there's no such thing, and we would just go on. I was doing it just to play devil's advocate with Mauro. If I were still doing commentary with Michael Cole or JR, we had the chemistry to where each one of these guys would have known that I was almost making a fool of myself by claiming like I was acting like I knew what this unbelievable-looking move was. Then either Cole or JR would have said, oh, King, you know better than that. With Byron and Tom, we don't have that chemistry yet. We have only been working together for a short time, so when I said that, they didn't even acknowledge it, so it kind of went out, and they just kept talking, and I kept talking. I didn't think about it either.
Wait, so it's Byron Tom's fault that they didn't catch old man Lawler when he was doing a racist?
It's their fault for not picking up on my sense of humor. I'm sorry if anyone was offended.
the biggest problem I mean, obviously there's the doing a racist part of this, but his presentation of the joke construction is just fundamentally dishonest, right? The whole reason you would call it that is that you're ignorant, but you're ignorant in an Archie Bunker style.
You can make that claim if you phrase the joke the right way. And, Like if he had, I mean, it's still hard. It's still not going to go over well. In
not trying to
age.
Get you into trouble here, but take me through this. I want to like
well,
give
I'm
me.
To,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of how he'd do it, but he'd put it on himself. Like if I was doing that move or something like that,
it'd be called the
part.
It's bling. Yeah. You know, yeah. No, even that would be problematic now.
Yeah. I thought there might be a self-deprecating way out of this. But then to say, hey, my straight men didn't come in here and save me is just asking.
I mean, that's and again, that goes back to the fundamental misrepresentation of the mechanics of comedy and joke construction, which when you talk about it like that gets like inherently unfunny. But if King is going to hide behind, no, this is a construct of humor, it's fair to go, okay, then, pal, what construct of humor is it?
Well, never mind. Lawler and his co-host then intimated that the intent was that the joke was supposed to be on him for being behind the times. Quote, that's where me, Bobby Heenan, Jesse Ventura, all of the heel commentators do that sort of stuff. And the joke is on yourself that the people out there say, look at that idiot. He doesn't even know what he's talking about and he thinks he does. That's where the joke was. Lawler did not apologize for the comment. Yeah, I think it probably would have been best. Hey, it was an attempt at a bad joke. It may have worked in the past, but it doesn't work now. I'm sorry.
Even a Gorilla Monsoon style, will you stop punchline rings, not hollow, but off with where the times are and where we are with comments like that. We would expect somebody to, you know, receive some sort of disciplinary action and not be allowed to be on a live microphone if they were making comments.
The real sin was it just wasn't funny.
Yeah, I mean, the original sin in all of this is that, like, you could get away with far more if it's actually funny, because part of something being funny tends to be that it's hitting on something honest, right? Whereas that's the other part is, go back to the original joke. What is the deeper truth that we're getting at when we mislabel a moonsault?
I mean, Heenan has two lines I can think of off the top of my head that you can't say in this day and age, but they were hilarious. So, you know, we don't.
Oh, Heenan has tons of lines that you can't say in this day and age. And some of them, like, it's weird because some of them now I'm like, the problematic versus, man, this is really funny.
Yeah.
Like that scale is really heavy on both sides now. But to that point, I'm willing to get past a lot of things with Heenan. One, because he's no longer with us and isn't here to talk or to explain his thinking and where he's thinking about these things at this current moment now. And two, he was funny as hell.
Yeah, people are now saying, hey, Jeff, what are the two lines you're thinking of? And, oh, no, you don't. No, hell no to the no. I am not getting canceled on my own podcast. Thank you.
That's my job.
No, jeez.
I will cancel you, sir.
Well, you know, like they canceled Star Trek. Oh no, sorry.
You just mail that one to me a little later. All right.
So moving on to NXT.
Moving on to NXT. Where do you want to begin?
Oh, I was hoping you had the lineup in front of you, but I assumed too much.
No, you just have so much faith in me. They're misplaced.
I know. Johnny and Candace.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What did you think of this presentation of them?
Boy, Johnny, what is he doing? I was watching this.
Well, let me answer that question. Maybe it'll clarify for you.
Okay.
He's playing insincere babyface.
Yes, I get that. I'm trying to understand when Johnny and Candace backstage were discussing what their on-screen dynamic is going to be like going forward. The insincere babyface thing makes sense, but I can't imagine the conversation between Johnny and Candace. I get that they're doing templates of characters. Candace is your standard mean heel, who used to be nice, but now has a mean edge. And I will say this. I thought Casey Catanzaro did her part pretty well. like, I thought she did a good job looking across the ring and seeing somebody who used to be her friend who's not her friend anymore. But Johnny did, I don't like his character right now.
Yeah, it's a little over the top. It's a little, I think people just want to see Johnny and Candace be good guys, to be honest with you.
I just don't think people are buying into the turn of Johnny and Candace.
Yeah. I think once audiences come back, they'll turn on them. And who knows? That might be as early as next week with crowds.
They have a bigger problem, which is going and trying to run again in front of quarter-filled audiences that are quarter-entertained by some of the booking choices that WWE has been making.
I just watched Casey, and I love her athleticism, but man, it looks like she's a child in there. And I couldn't get past that.
So she's so slight of frame that you just see obvious limits to what she can bring as a solo act. And my mind was thinking about, okay, who she should be paired with is a monster heel character who you want to get over as a baby face for a length of time and actually have like the big person, small person friend dynamic. So let's say you want to turn Reyna Gonzalez at some point and make her the monster baby face. And she's on like a push to a championship title run or whatever. And Casey is her friend and her sidekick or whatever. And they do tag team matches and they have cool little tandem spots. I think she's got a real place as the baby face in peril in a tag match. As a singles talent, there's a clear ceiling because of her size.
Because of her size, I mean, you know, every hard, you know, collision, I just kind of, you know, because she's had injury problems before, you know, if she was in there with a Nia Jax, I'd be, and this isn't a slight on Nia Jax more than it's just people who go in with Nia Jax have to be physical with her. And they have to take those bumps to make her look good.
Oh, yeah. She'd have to be jumping off the top rope and trying to hit missile drop kicks to Nia Jax.
And getting slammed hard.
Or doing a kick off of Nia Jax and then just thudding onto the canvas. I mean, really rough bumps for her. I think that she needs to be – she would have been great if she had really been long-term booked as Candice LeRae's best friend, and that this was a deeper storyline, because like that's kind of the underdog ceiling for her, and Candace is about as big as she can credibly be working underdog without you having serious issues. It is neat though to have someone theoretically who can seem like an underdog going into the ring against Kaylee Ray, right? Kaylee Ray is not a very big person, but Casey Cat and Nizarro.
She's vicious, and they can work that.
If Nizarro booked properly and established properly, would be someone perfect to tell that story with. I just see real problems with her as a singles talent.
I think also, look, the time to push her was after that first Rumble thing when she came out because she still had the American Ninja Warrior fame on her, and now that's kind of a few years removed.
And they've already done all the big Kofi Kingston-like spots with her to limited effect at this point. Yeah, no, I'm with you. She was more popular and better known 3-4 years ago at this point. They've done the signature spots that theoretically should have established her. And I think even when they've used her on the main roster in a very limited capacity, I don't think they really believe in her as a main every week TV on screen talent. And if they don't, then like they need to figure out what the NXT plan is for.
I think the new finisher is interesting. It's an homage to her stay at PWG all those years, doing mixed tags with Joey Ryan against like the Young Bucks and whatnot. That is Super Dragon's old finisher, the Super Curb Stomp or what have you. I'm interested that she's the one doing it. She actually took one, as I recall, in PWG when I was there once. So that's, you know, I like little homages to your former life in the indies. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, and I think it gets over that new mean attitude. Absolutely. It's the Johnny Candace dynamic as heels doesn't work for me, but we've already kind of went over that.
What else was on this show? We had more cruiserweight matches. We had Drake Maverick beat Tony Nese and then cut a fiery promo that he's not going anywhere. I'm still very uncomfortable with this story, Chris. I don't care if he's staying or not.
I don't care if he's staying or not, and I don't care how good he is, and he's fantastic, and I am a huge rock star Spud Drake Maverick fan. I always have been for the last 7-8 years. We're going on like 10 years now. This story is extraordinarily icky. It is insensitive, to say the least, not only to all the people who were independent contractors who had their contracts, there some of which were quote-unquote multi-year deals, just dissolved, but also to the people who are watching at home who are on the furlough to see this story sort of played out and just used as storyline fodder. Now, I don't like it, and it's a damn shame because I want to be all in on Drake Maverick finally getting some go and this company seeing what I have seen in this guy for the better part of 10 years.
In a rematch from Lucha Underground to start off the show, El Hijo del Fantasma, a.k.a. King Cuerno, took on Isaiah Swerve Scott, a.k.a. Killshot. Liked the match. Found it interesting that they beat El Hijo del Fantasma.
Yeah,
I think it's part of the bigger story with the mask guys and how it's obvious he's not fighting them. But they're trying to – I'm loving that part of the story. And I thought Isaiah Swerve Scott cut a hell of a promo after this match too.
Yeah, no, I like the – I like the Hijo del Fantasma thing. I do like the – he's not actually fighting them and he's not
really – Wrestling Kaiser Soze I am here for. I am
all – no. For sure. It's good deviousness. I think it made this match a little bit weird. You're like, oh, okay, we're gonna have Swerve Scott win. Yeah, and I wouldn't beat Hijo del Fantasma, but also if you're thinking about this in terms of do wins and losses really matter for his character right now, standard wrestling booking would say not at all, because you're about to turn him heel. I would push back on that though slightly and say we're just establishing this guy though, and Swerve Scott is, I think he should be beating all of these people.
Well, it felt like he was in line to possibly get this cruiserweight title when they did that four-way with Devlin and he and the Buzzsaw, the Kiwi Buzzsaw. And
That's right. Yeah, people were really into Swerve. So maybe I'm underappreciating where Swerve is in the pecking order, especially in the cruiserweight division these days.
Yeah, I'm starting to lean towards they're going to elevate him on that side of the bracket, but the story is going to be all El Hijo del Fantasma and these masked guys, and eventually it's all going to come to a head.
If it came to a head, oh no, it might all come to a head with Drake Maverick's character being cannibalized to tell the rest of that story.
That could be too. I mean, so in the hit or miss category, how was the Newly Bros show for you?
This was a miss for me, bro.
I think Tom Phillips sounds like a game show announcer. I think Byron Phillips acts like a game show host. I thought this started off well and then just fell off a cliff. I appreciate what they're trying to do here. I don't know if that's how you want to present Timothy Thatcher. That's all.
Yeah, I don't know if that's how you want to present Timothy Thatcher. Yeah, and that's the other part is this is Riddle. I mean, even Riddle as – Riddle is such a 90s version of what a stoner is, right? He is a really dated archetype of a stoner. He's the guy from the turn of the century who's listening to Sublime every day. And so even to that point, pot culture has moved on beyond that. How much do you want to be highlighting pot culture? That's certainly an open question to discuss, but we've moved past that, so I'll leave it to the side here. But the presentation of Riddle, if you're going to embrace that, needs to be more reflective of where your Stoner is now. Maybe watch Pineapple Express. That movie's almost 15 years old, but that would give you a much fresher coat of paint on what a current stoner looks like.
Oh, it feels like they went back to old, not even ECW, but WWF Rob Van Dam promos. And right, they're trying to play that cute, because look, I appreciated the "my wife wakes and bakes me breakfast" line. Okay, that was cute, but they're trying to get over a Rob Van Dam type character, and I think there's more to this guy than that. And I think comedy needs to not be the comedy in this needs to not be played hard for comedy.
No, you know the thing though about Rob Van Dam, great, I'm glad you brought him up. Because, yes, Rob Van Dam was a pothead, and you looked at his tights, and there's, like, the airbrush on yin-yang and 420, and, like, his tights are totally a 90s stoner paradise. Also, it was the 1990s, so it was current and reflective of where culture was. But the other thing that Rob Van Dam always got over, and this is independent of the promos, was his badassery by doing the split-legged chair stretch. The first time I saw that on TV, I thought he was one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. That and the first time I saw him dive from the turnbuckle into the crowd. And I was like, you know, 10, I thought it was like 10,000 feet away. I couldn't believe anyone could do that. I mean, Rob Van Dam was also established as a physical talent and a physical presence, and someone who was not the biggest guy, but was so technically savvy that you had to respect him. And underneath the casual "bro, whoa, I've been getting high all day" stuff was also a guy who was sitting there and doing a ton of stretches and stuff, and you knew that this guy did serious stuff. With Matt Riddle's character, we never see him really doing serious stuff. Or, more importantly, he does serious stuff every so often, but he doesn't have a serious signature stuff training spot in the same way that Rob Van Dam had these split chair stretches.
Yeah, and it was also just the, you know, whatever guy was supposed to offset his badassery. And we haven't seen the badassery in Riddle except really that one match against Adam Cole, I think.
And Cassius Ohno, I think, would be another example.
Yeah, that was more of a, well, in Evolve it was, not in WWE necessarily. But yeah, I get what you're saying there. Charlotte Flair versus Mia Yim I thought was very, very good. I'm a little shocked they're going to EO this quick, but I assume it'll probably be like Charlotte putting her feet on the ropes and pinning her, because I thought the story was Charlotte cleans out the division and then EO beats her. So this is an interesting
thing. I think she might, I think it might be foot on the ropes. It might be some sort of banana peel finish where she does not cleanly beat EO Shirai, then tries to move on beyond Io Shirai, and then Io Shirai is chasing Charlotte.
And she's just crazy the entire time. It's like right. She's screaming about the leg on the ropes, and then, you know, Charlotte will be cutting a promo the next week because she has a real tough match this week with Tegan Nox, and then here comes Io. You know, just screaming all sorts of Japanese obscenities, hopefully, doing that, because I don't mind crazy Io. I like crazy Io quite a bit, but it's an interesting way to do this. I mean, I did like my way of just having every babyface beat Charlotte, and then she eventually beats EO. But we'll see what happens here. I wonder if they're getting nervous about her being on this show with low ratings, quote unquote low ratings. They're still quite good. It's not.
Yeah, no, they need to bring her back to the ratings juggernaut.
It's hurting her star power. So we need to bring her back to Raw or whatever. I could see that being a mindset.
Yeah, ratings juggernaut Raw. Let's get her back onto there.
Dexter Lumis beat Shane Thorne. Okay.
Dexter Lumis as a babyface is
so weird.
It's so weird, right?
Boo Radley being the
yeah. It's like it is very, very strange. I would actually, you know what? I'm going to make it because you've been mean to me. It's Gul Dukat as a babyface, who noted heel on Deep Space Nine. It's just uncomfortable. You don't want to root for Dukat. You know that Dukat's not a babyface character. You're not sure why this is happening.
You know who? What it reminds me a lot of, and it's not quite to that point, but they it is kind of a trope in these especially these 60s and 70s movies where you have a bunch of character actors going on a mission or something. Like in the original Magnificent Seven, one of my favorite characters in that movie is Robert Vaughn's Lee, the gunfighter who has lost his nerve. And so everybody's kind of, he says a lot of weird things just, you know, in a very passive aggressive way. And everybody's just kind of looks at each other and goes, is this guy going to be okay? That's exactly who Dexter Loomis is in this thing. It's like if you had like an 8-man tag and three guys were going, who could we get? And you just hear this weird, creepy voice in the background. I'll be your partner. It's like, wait, what? Who let Dexter Loomis in our locker room? You know, that kind of thing.
Was Velveteen Dream on this show this week?
He is hyped for next week, I believe.
Right. Yeah, no, it's interesting. We had a week of him not on TV.
Week of him not on TV because of charges that have not been... so we're still not talking about this, huh?
Yeah, I guess not. Are we? I don't know.
I don't know, because nothing's happened with it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's really the bigger thing is the news is... The news, I mean, there's one part of the story of, are the allegations true? And, you know, we're still waiting to find out more about that. But the one thing that we can say, you know, positively right now is that the company has not taken any apparent action that we're aware of at the time of broadcast.
Yes, there are allegations, because we have to talk about it now because we brought it up. But there are allegations that Velveteen Dream does some not great things on social media.
And also uses voice messaging and stuff, and some of those voice messages also made it out there, and you can listen to them for yourself and, you know, decide.
To teenagers who are not teenagers above the age of 18. How about that?
Yeah.
that's a diplomatic way.
But I think it's also a precise way of explaining the situation.
Okay, good. Shane Thorne, I don't know why you beat him here if you're going to make him a part of the tag team scene up on top on Raw. I don't get that.
It's weird. And, like, I think Dexter Loomis, this is a weird choice for him as a babyface, too, because he's going up against an underdog heel. So you almost find yourself rooting for Shane Thorne in a way, because Thorne's the underdog here and Loomis is the bigger guy. And you can't, because you're trying to build up Loomis, you can't give Thorne too much offense, so you can't really let Loomis work from under either. It's strange. It was a very strange tone in this match. I like the finisher. I like him choking the life out of people. I think it works for the character.
Is that a good babyface move, though?
I don't know, but is he really a baby? Long term, is he a babyface? I think not. I mean, my gut tells me long term this guy isn't a babyface.
Right.
So I'm not worried so much about that. What I am worried about is making the sell to people and getting them to bite on the idea that this guy might actually be a babyface, which I don't think he is, but I think you need to trick people. And I don't know that they've done a lot of work on that front.
And then we already did Maverick and Nice. Keith Lee retained his title against Damian Priest. Thought that was a pretty damn good big man match, and then it had kind of a sports entertainment ending with the nightstick. But up until then, I really was enjoying this. I think Damian Priest needs to be part of a group. And I think they need to actually have group interview types. Like if he and Finn Balor were made a package, I could see loving that quite a bit.
No. I got it. Damian Priest and Hijo del Fantasma need to be like a tag team, and you need to have the two mass dudes as kind of the underlings. But whatever this future faction is with Hijo, Priest needs to be a part of it.
Okay.
Because then you've got a really solid promo base too. Phantasma's a good promo. We talked about this before. I like him. He's got a good command of English. But if you have him and Priest there, like those two guys can totally carry the energy that I think needs to happen.
And that's all I want. I just want some solid promos, and I think Priest can do that. But I think this character, especially there's nothing. I love Damian Priest, but boy, when he does that weird, the weird gesticulations during the dun, 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 dun in his theme music, I just go, that's so lame. I just want him to be a bad.
Yeah, his like weird rocking out thing.
Yeah.
That he, yes. No. I hate that. Like that. Everything that he does when he comes out is lame as hell, right? And he's just
the arrow
rising above a garbage entrance.
You know, make him like Larry Fishburne in King of New York or something. You know, just have him be that kind of, because that's what I thought he'd be kind of.
Think about
when
how
they
much
did the first promos.
Gangrel's entrance.
I don't even need him to be supernatural though, man. I just, you know, just
Gangrel just came up on the platform with the flames. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to go all the way and have him drinking the blood or whatever. Although like the chalice did give Gangrel a little thing, and Priest was kind of working sort of like that.
Yeah. I got an archetype for you. Cyrus from the movie The Warriors.
Okay.
The
all
guy
right.
who goes, can yeah. you dig it?
Yeah.
Him. Yeah. That'd be kind of cool. That's all I got. You got anything else?
No, I think that's it. That's all I got.
Plug your shears.
Okay, so Don't Worry About the Government has lots of new episodes out. I've been cranking them out like I would love to be doing on a regular basis. Go and check those out on don'tworry.tv. Also, if you want to support the show, patreon.com/DWATG. You can get premium content too. Put out a premium episode this week. So if you're interested in that, go and check that out. On the Family Podcast is available for listening. We will be taping again at some point. I don't know when that is. And you can find me on Twitter at CHRISNOVEMBRINO.
As always, if you want to give us a tip, you can do it at our Red Circle site where the show is hosted. Part of the Voices of Wrestling Network. Listen to all our shows. If you don't like us, there's probably some wrestling that you do like that you like to listen about. Open the Voice Gate, everything AEW, and of course the flagship with Joe and Rich talking all around the horn of Japanese and American wrestling and even some Mexico here and there. I'm Jeff Hawkins.
If you don't like us,
no, they like us.
No, they should. If they don't, they should take a long look in the mirror.
Oh.
And really ask themselves what's broken inside of them.
You know what they shouldn't like is Star Trek.
Yeah, they should like Star Trek.
No, they should not.
No, yeah, they Happy birthday, loser.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.